This is Bill Tiller of Tiller.org. You're listening to BBSRadio.com. Don't forget to tune in to The Infinite Consciousness with Eva Herr every Sunday at 7 p.m. Pacific Time. Enjoy.
Welcome to Infinite Consciousness this week, and thanks for listening. Today, I'm very honored to have with us Dr. Irvin Laszlo. Is it doctor? I'm sure it is. Irvin?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay. Scare me here for a second. Thought Don had disconnected us. How are you?
Okay, pretty good, pretty good.
So we're going to talk about consciousness and your new book, Science in the Akashic Field, which is, I loved it, Irvin. I thought it was a wonderful book. And I'm so glad to see somebody putting that in writing, everything that you did. It was great. So if you don't mind, would you tell my listeners just a little bit about you and your background before we get started?
Fine, as you like. Okay. Shall we get on with that?
Just tell us a little bit about you and your background. I mean, you're an amazing man. You've been nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize, what, 3 times already?
Well, twice, actually. I hope next time I get it. But
I do, too. Certainly very deserving. So tell us a little bit about you.
Eva, it's difficult to talk about yourself, you know. I mean, supposedly that's the most difficult thing, to know thyself. It's already the oracle at Delphi said that that's what you should be doing. I've had a rather crazy life because I started out as a concert pianist, as a child prodigy, and nobody ever thought that I'd do anything else in my life but perform music and as a concert pianist. And that's what I thought, too, until it turned out that my childhood impressions in my home city where I grew up, Budapest in Hungary, had left a lasting impression. Namely, my mother was a piano teacher, and my uncle, who lived in the same house, was a philosopher. And so in the morning, I would practice piano with my mother, and I would also go to school. And in the afternoon, very often, not every day, but several times a week, I would go for walks with my uncle, who was telling me about the ideas and why it's important to inquire into what kind of world this is and what our role is in it, etc. You know. So then I thought all that is forgotten, and I was just going to go on as a pianist because I was became pretty well known already as a child. As a concert pianist, and then it what happened, I don't really know what happened, but as I went on and played a lot of concerts all over the world, then I got married and settled down, and then I thought, well, let me think a little bit about more serious things, and I got involved with some of the ideas that were coming to me in my childhood, and I decided to go into them seriously. I started reading, started attending courses, ended up by publishing a book more or less by chance because I didn't intend to. It just sort of came about, which is another story in itself. And then I got invited to Yale University, to the philosophy department, even though all I had was a music degree before. And then I wrote more books, and then I got a degree at the Sorbonne and got various appointments and so on. And then I ended up by being on loan to the United Nations for a year, ended up by staying there 7 years as director of research. And when I returned, left that engagement, then instead of going back to the university, I thought, before I get back to my ivory tower, I go and take a sabbatical leave for myself. And I had this old farmhouse in Italy, and that was 20 years ago, and that sabbatical is still lasting. Of course, now I'm working more than ever since I left the UN. I've been more busy than ever, but I'm now doing it when I want and where I want and how I want and being entirely my own master. So that's, in a capsule form, the past 50 years.
Wow. Well, did you do any training in quantum mechanics or in physics, or do you just know?
Not formally. I have many friends. I attended many courses already at Yale University, then in Germany, the Sorbonne. I always inquired into what does it mean, you know. So basically I was not concerned as much with the mechanics, how to test it, how to make experiments, how to calculate it. I left that to people who are already onto that and are specialized in it. I said always, what does it mean? So I was trying to put together the results from different disciplines, from physics to biology to cosmology to psychology and, you know, brain research. And so I could move very freely. And as a philosopher, because finally I ended up teaching philosophy and philosophy of science, I had, so to speak, a license to move wherever I wanted. And that's what I did.
Well, let me ask you, first of all, what is your definition of consciousness? I've been doing an experiment, well, a little research project where I've been asking some of the great luminaries in the world, what is that thing? You know, what is mind? And you would be amazed at how many different answers I get for that one word.
Well, that's sort of the biggest mystery of all, because there seem to be two possibilities if you want to be really consistent. Either our consciousness is all there is in the world, because after all, everything that appears to us through our consciousness. So either that's the totality of the world and everything is consciousness, or the world is really all physics and all matter and mass and energy, and consciousness is just kind of a byproduct. So I don't like either one of these solutions, actually. I don't think either one is satisfactory. And here I use the word satisfactory in the sense in which the great philosopher Alfred North Whitehead used it. He said that theory has to be not just correct, but also satisfactory, because you have an inner sense, an insight, which tells you, well, if you are on the right track or not. So I think that consciousness, to get finally back to the definition and answer your question, I think consciousness is the inner readout, is what you get when you are part of the world, but you are seeing it from inside. You're seeing it from your own particular point of view. And I believe that you see it, the whole world, from your point of view, because it's your consciousness and I have mine. And each of us has this consciousness. And it encompasses all the rest of the world from our point of view. But I think that everything in the world has consciousness, but different levels of consciousness, because each has, use the modern term perhaps, as a readout. You know, as a readout, there is an external readout and an internal readout. The internal readout is consciousness. The external readout is what physics tells you and what brain sciences tell you. There are neurons and particles and molecules, etc., you know, in the body. So I think consciousness is there in everything, in the whole universe, and our consciousness is part of the consciousness of the cosmos.
So would it be subjective?
It's subjective because but not in a negative sense. Everything is subjective in the sense I am the subject. I experience the world. It's my consciousness. I feel it like this. And I'm pretty sure my dog feels the world also. And I'm pretty sure the plants feel the world. I think everything, the cells in my body feel the rest of the world in their own way, at their own level of articulateness. We can feel it a very, very articulate way because our brain is highly complex and it allows us to articulate that cosmic consciousness which is there in the universe in a way in which we can see many more things, we can identify things, and we can think about them. So we have a highly evolved kind of consciousness because we have a highly evolved kind of an organism.
Let me ask you another question first. Do you think that consciousness would also consist of sensate awareness, emotional awareness, cognitive awareness, and self-awareness?
In a general sense, I use consciousness as everything that you feel, that happens to you, everything that you perceive. That means all intuitions also. I'm not using it only in the sense of sense perceptions. That's part of it. But whatever happens to you, whatever you intuit, whatever goes on to you as a living experience reality is part of this stream that accompanies you from birth to death. And I'm pretty sure that's another theme. I'm pretty sure it continues after physical death as well. But this is consciousness, is the totality of all the things that one experiences.
Would you think that it would be the irreducible unit? So that would be the totality of everything?
Well, everything is consists of whole. You cannot take apart. But you cannot know everything all at once. Again, Whitehead, who was, as you might gather, one of the great influences on me, he said, since everything is connected with everything else, we'd be logically obliged to say everything at once. But we can't say everything at once, and it would make sense. So we have to pull things down, take things apart. So there is an irreducibility to everything. But we, in order to know things, in order to get along in the world, to see things, we are analyzing them into pieces. And a big task and challenge is to put it together. Don't think that they're only pieces. To see the whole and not only the trees, see the forest, even though what we see in front of us are trees.
Okay. I agree with you. I just have so many questions for you. I hope I'm able to get them all in this hour. What would your definition of mind be?
I don't see mind. I get the different words as being different from consciousness. It is different, you know. If you say consciousness is limited to conscious awareness. Yes, if you think of consciousness as being a specific conscious awareness of yourself or of your world or of your perceptions, then, of course, mind is much more encompassing. But if you use consciousness, like I've just said, as the totality of all your experience, then it's equal to mind. That your mind is consciousness. Consciousness is the mind.
Well, the reason I'm asking these specific kinds of questions like that is because it's kind of my goal, to try to help bridge the gap between science and spirituality. And
yes.
So many of the conventional scientists or medical doctors, as a matter of fact, don't understand that that it doesn't boil down to the organ, the brain. So I'm trying to help them understand that consciousness is different from the brain, and consciousness is different from what they see the mind to be, because they think the mind's contained within the brain, you know. So that's why I'm asking these kind of questions. Do you think that the brain thinks? Or do you think
No.
the brain is an organ that's processing consciousness, that brain mediates consciousness maybe for the awareness part anyway?
What I like and where I think the great tie-in is between science and spirituality is if you look at the world, the universe itself as intelligent in some sense, you know. There's a whole big argument in that too, you know, which you can get onto later if you like.
Mm-hmm.
But there are good reasons to believe that this is not an accidental world, that too many things are fine-tuned in such a way that certain things can happen. So if you think that the universe has underlying it or governing it, a kind of a consciousness, then the tie-in with spirituality is to say that, yes, our brain is part of this world. We know it's connected to this world in multiple ways, and more ways that we are now discovering. And the way the brain picks up the rest of the world is the way it extracts from this universal consciousness that particular chunk or segment that is my consciousness, you know,
mm-hmm.
the individual consciousness. So we are simply just articulating the totality, the total seed of consciousness which is there in the cosmos into our individual consciousness. And it would be a big mistake to think that the rest doesn't exist, that's all there is. And it would be a big mistake also to think that this consciousness that I have is merely just something produced like a kind of a byproduct by the gray cells operating in inside us, by one's skull. So I think there is a direct tie-in because all great spiritual traditions talk about an initial cosmic oneness that is being energy that bursts forth and is descending and gradually becoming more and more material until it becomes sort of the body, and the consciousness
mm-hmm.
is something that's associated with that.
Mm-hmm.
So you can, these are symbolic ways of phrasing it, and science would phrase it in different ways. But it comes to the same thing. We are not separate from the rest, and we are not purely material. We are not purely just mind either. We have both aspects. We have an external aspect, which if you look at from the outside, it appears to you as a physical organism, or a physical, chemical, or biological chemical organism. And if you look at it from the inside, from your point of view of your own experience, then this same organism appears to you as mind, as the totality of the flow of consciousness.
Mm-hmm. What do you believe to be the source of creativity and intentionality?
Well, because we are part. We are part of a conscious and intentional and self-evolving universe. The tremendous drive in nature that brought forth complex systems that we can call living is a fantastic act of creativity, constant creativity, with occasional tremendous breakthroughs, like when bacteria learn to photosynthesize or learn to feed on oxygen, and then to feed on sunshine, and then to become multicellular instead of just staying on the single cells. And then the multicellulars constantly to become mutate in such a way that they can live in a complex environment and they can contain more and more structure and more information, to use that term now, which is, I think, very important, and govern themselves increasingly. So all that is a constant act of creativity. Again, what White has called it the creative advance into novelty. Always into something new is happening, and the entire universe is moving constantly into novelty, from the Big Bang on to, through the galaxies, and they play out this tremendous symphony of galactic evolution, and within the galaxies, the star systems, and within some star systems, planets, and on planets, the forms of life that evolve. So that's a constant creativity, and we are part of that tremendous symphony, a drive toward structure, toward complexity.
I think about this all the time. How do you think the original intention began? How do you, you know, obviously it came from energy, and how do you think that original intention or thought of creativity began?
In the universe or as individually?
Yeah.
How do you mean?
Yeah, in the universe.
Yeah.
I mean, I can see a field out there, but how did it get started?
Well, that's, if you can't, I know, it's not a $64,000 question, it's the $64 trillion question, you know? It's the biggest mystery of all, how it got started. There are various ways of looking at it, but you said it's all energy. I think here, right away, we have to add a term. I think the basis of the universe is both energy and information.
Yes.
Information is what structures energy. Energy is all there is. You know, there is no such thing as matter. This may come as a shock to many people, but what matter is structured energy. They are standing waves of energy. We know that very well. Particles are really not material. They are swirls of energy. They maintain themselves in the same place, although they are instantly interconnected, and they are very mysterious beasts, but they're certainly not just bits of matter. So, and everything else is made of particles, and atoms, they're made of atoms and molecules and cells and crystals and so on. So, there is no matter, but that doesn't matter, so to speak, because what there is energy, which is the hardware of the universe. What there is various forms of energy. But how this energy behaves is not accidental. And it was there from the very beginning. It gives the laws of nature. There are laws of nature. There are ways energy can behave, the ways the particles can combine with each other, and the ways energy can be radiated through as electromagnetism or as gravitation or as nuclear fields or any other. And all this depends on information. The way this universe is, the way the information that was there from the very beginning is structuring and governing and evolving energy.
Okay. I have trouble sometimes getting across what I want to say because of vocabulary issues, linguistics. So I'm going to try to do the best I can here, and I'm going to have to use words that sometimes people don't agree with, such as frequencies. Like the word frequency, a lot of the physics people have a problem with
frequency, yeah.
Frequency, you know. But I don't know any way to describe it because I don't have the right vocabulary for it. But how do you think the source of intentionality or creativity conveys the information to an individual for us? Do you think that it goes through electromagnetism and maybe through pulsing and voltage, you know, like maybe like the Morse code, like da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, and it would have some kind of voltage behind it that's sending it through electromagnetism, perhaps? I don't really know how to ask the question. I hope you can understand what I'm trying to get across.
Yeah, I think so. I'm trying to understand. I think so. It makes perfect sense. It's a very good, important question. You know, here is where I can come refer to the theories that I've been developing the past 15, 20 years or so. I've been always looking at evolution as a series of interconnected systems that move more and more towards complexity and toward meaning. But how does this communicate with one another? So here is where I say that information is coming to us in multiple ways, but it is not accidental, and it's not limited to what the established sciences recognize as electromagnetic information or gravitational information or nuclear information. I think there is an information field in itself. That information is structured and is there. It's produced. Whatever you do, it produces information, and this information is registered. So this is a different kind of a concept, but a concept that follows very logically from all our experience. Nothing happens purely by chance. Nothing happens purely as an individual thing that is not connected with other things. And when something happens once, it is conserved. It is there. It influences whatever happens after that.
Mm-hmm.
So nothing is purely evanescent. Nothing disappears or vanishes without a trace. So this is what I'll be calling the Akashic field, or the field similar to what the Hindus sages have called the Akasha, the fundamental medium of the universe that records everything. So I think what comes to us is coming to us through intuition, through information of the conscious kind, but also through subconscious kinds. Very often we have feelings, we sense certain things, and those things are perfectly good, legitimate sources of information. Not sometimes produced by our brain alone inside, and they have no particular reference to outside, but many times, and perhaps most of the time, there is something in the world that is communicated to us, not always through so-called sense data, through feeling or seeing red or blue or hard or soft or smelling things, etc., or feeling, hearing different sounds, but coming to us in our subconscious, and then it's a question for us to become conscious of it. So our brain is an instrument of very high fine-tuning. It can range, you talked about frequency before, it can pick up a very high, wide range of frequencies in the world. And our conscious awareness, especially in the Western world, where we are filtered out a lot of the things because we don't believe that they exist, so our conscious awareness only contains a very small fragment of all that actually reaches the brain. The brain is a receiver and a transmitter at the same time. It's a transceiver. But of what the brain receives, we only become aware, normally, of a very small fragment.
Okay. I'm just going to ask you questions instead of dialogue.
Yeah, go ahead.
Because I want to get as
much
not easy
questions, but I'll try my best.
How do you think that this individuality exists? Do you think the soul is in... Oh, gosh, that's a hard question. Do you think the soul is in our aura or our electromagnetic field? How does individuality arise? Does that make sense?
Well, again, we are at the very, very edge of what is knowable, or what is known for the time being, and perhaps what is knowable, but I think we can get further still. I mean, there are a lot more things unknowable than we know to date. But certainly each thing in this universe has an individuality. I mean, starting with the individual particle, going on to the cells, to the organisms, and then going on to stellar systems and galaxies, and perhaps entire universes. We all have individuality. But they maintain themselves as, you might say, let me use a simile here, an analog, like a wave. You look at a wave, And then you see that the wave is having a kind of individuality. It's traveling. Maybe when it reaches the shore, it breaks, but as long as it's on the body of water, a wave can travel. And there are certain kind of waves that are known as solitons. They are very curious waves. They look like they were the actual sort of balls moving around on top of a surface of a liquid, of some kind of a medium. And they look like they will be individual. Actually, they are part of that medium. They are just a very complex kind of a wave.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I look at particles and I look at all things that have individuality as a kind of a complex wave traveling over the entire sea, which is the sea, which is space-time, which is the whole universe as an interconnected whole, you know, a constant, an underlying whole, you know, in everything. It's a field. So individuality is there as a wave traveling all over a complex field. I don't know, that's not an easy definition, but that's sort of the best I can come up with.
Yeah. Do you think it literally has something to do with the body and the aura? And how can the body make it? Do you think the body helps establishes individuality? How does it?
We are bodies. I'm in the sense of the what I call the external readout. You know, when you look at it from the outside, what you see.
That's
is
a good
the body.
Definition. Okay, external yeah. radar. Good job. I like that.
So,
okay, I can understand that.
So of course we are the body, and it's there. But we are more than just a body, because when we sense the world not as a body. We sense it through our body, but we sense
right.
it as a mind. You know, that comes
right.
to us as our consciousness. So individuality is a body-mind individuality. It's there, and it's constant. But what I'm trying to emphasize is that it's not separate. And here is perhaps another bridge that you can have this build with spirituality. Because in spirituality, you know that we are one, you know. We are
right.
part of a much larger whole. And if you consider these newer approaches from the new sciences, you see that an individual body is a complex wave. It's very much part of the whole, you know. So it's just an illusion that we are separate.
Right. That was a really good way to put it. For somebody that if somebody didn't understand, that was a good way to describe it. Do you think that we have complete free will? And what I mean by this is I'm a believer of non-duality. And I think that we're not driving the car. And so I don't think if we had complete free will, then you could say, Eva, meet me at the grocery store at 3 o'clock. I would be there at 3 o'clock, not 1 minute before and not 1 minute after. And we can't guarantee that, so I don't think we have complete free will.
Yeah, no, there is no complete free will and no complete determinism either. I think what you can see is how the freedom that's built into the universe, because it's built into it. I don't think the future is decided. It's not decided by the past or the present. It's always a creative advance, as I said, into a novelty, into the next step. So it's a question of degree. The more complex a body, or an organism, or an entity of any kind, can be a society, can be an information system, you know, whatever. The more complex it is, the more it interiorizes the factors that can render, that can make it free. You know, the decisions come more from the inside of the system rather than from the outside. Look at it, a very simple thing, like a piece of matter of some kind, you know, like a bit of iron or stone or whatever. All the information it gets, it happens to it from the outside. It doesn't decide what happens to it, you know. Already, quanta, by the way, grew particles on their own. They have a sense. They have already an element of self-decision. But when you get to complex systems, they more and more decide what is happening to them. So they have a degree of freedom that increases with the complexity, with the decision-making possibility. It's like a complex computer can make many more decisions than a simple mechanical typewriter. A mechanical typewriter mm-hmm. just carries out what you bang out on the keyboard. A complex computer already gets signals, and often its program decides what it's going to do.
Okay. Do you think that there is a quantum of self and a quantum of time? or and also a quantum of consciousness, like the consciousness unit I mentioned earlier. I mean, there's a
individual units. There are individual units that we can break things down, but I think they are fairly artificial. I'm, you know, there's a great debate that's been going on in the physics community now for ever since Einstein came up with the theory of relativity. It's almost 100 years, but particularly since the quantum revolution in the 1920s, the debate is are things continuous or are they sort of quantized, you know, broken up into bits and pieces? I think the great challenge is to see the continuity behind, beyond the quanta, the individual bits and pieces. It turns out that everything that's propagated, everything that we can measure, comes in quanta, comes in separate chunks. But these chunks are also part of something deeper. And so to my mind, that what we break things apart are units. Like a time is a continuous flow, but we break it apart into seconds and minutes and hours and so on. You know?
Okay.
The same way as things are in front of us are continuous waves, as it were, but a continuous medium, like something that waves, like the ocean. That what we see are the individual waves. And we sometimes make the mistake, and very often, in fact, that we think of the waves as being individual, and then we forget that they're actually waves of or waves in something much larger than they.
Do you think that, I hope I can get this across too, I kind of see the universe as being infinite and continuing, in that it has a hierarchy that goes up to a peak, and then maybe it inverts and starts over and continues constantly like that. Does that make any sense to you?
A lot of sense, a lot of sense indeed. But that's, you know, there's an ancient notion, again, talking about bridges between spirituality and science, the ancient notion in the Hindu philosophy has always been universes that come and go, that evolve, that flower. It's like a breathing in and out. The cosmos breathes in and out. You know, when it exhales, all these universes come, flower force can move forward and develop, evolve. And then it breathes in, they come back again to the source. And then at the next breath, another universe continues. And the new concept in cosmology are these multiverses. That's what talked about today as the concept. The universe is not, this universe is not all that there is. This universe is part of a series, of a cycle of universes. Itself sometimes called the megaverse or the metaverse, there are different names given to it. But the fact is that there are cycles of universes. So each universe evolves up to a maximum point. Then we know from all the physical processes that we can observe in the cosmos that it can't continue forever. After a given time, the kind of processes that build matter or, you know, particles into systems, into galaxies, and eventually, it must stop because the energy gets used up. Then, you know, this universe starts to collapse. It ends up in a series of black holes, and the last of these enormous galaxy-sized black holes collapses. Then everything that has been there, that's notable, that's manifest, that made up a universe, disappears. But the foundation into which it falls back, which is misleadingly called the vacuum, which is actually not an empty space, it's the most fundamental element from which all things emerge. Then from here, other universes can burst forth. And possibly they burst forth even before one universe disappears, because some black holes could be the beginnings of other universes. So absolutely, what you say is absolutely right. There are periodic cycles which involve everything there is.
How did you know these things, Irvin? Did you have a spiritual epiphany, or was it just a gradual process?
Of course, it's an inquiry, a lot of inquiry, but you have to have a nose for it, so to speak. You have to know what you're looking for. There's an awful lot. That's the biggest question. You get flooded by data if you just look, just try to pick up everything you know, everything that's around you. Then you can't get much further than a single part, a small part of a single discipline, because there's so much knowledge in every one of these disciplines. One lifetime is not enough to pick it all up. But you have to have a nose. You have to know what is really significant and how then to put together if I can contribute something or have contributed something, it's this ability or the result of the ability of picking out things that I believe are significant, that reflect something that you have good reasons to call reality, and putting it together so that it makes some kind of sense to us, which is not purely arbitrary or subjective, but we have good reasons to believe that it reflects something about what is really happening in the world.
Mm-hmm. What do you think, speaking of epiphanies, I don't want to spend too long here because I got some more questions.
There were epiphanies, by the way. I mean, I had several cases like that, you know, and they give you sudden insights and you can follow them up. My entire looking for an Akashic field, for example, was the result of an epiphany at one mm-hmm. point. But then it's a question of following it up.
Right. What do you think? I want to just tell you something quickly that happened to me because it changed my life a lot. I went from being a fundamental Baptist walking down the street, and then I had some kind of horrible dark night of the soul, and something happened in my sleep where I thought I went to the other side and I saw my dead father. And then the next morning I woke up and I knew about all of the stuff that I'm asking you, and I'd never heard of it before. What causes that to happen? How does that happen?
Well, I know this happens, and I have similar experiences. I'm not sure that I knew everything all of a sudden, but one has intuitions, and it comes usually at the borderline between sleep and wakefulness, when one is not in deep sleep, but when one allows the brain to pick up information that normally is suppressed. Remember how I talked earlier, I said all the information comes as a very small fragment, becomes only conscious. In this state of white dreaming or being semi-conscious, much more information can come. If one is lucky enough, then we'll remember some of it and then can use it and can take it seriously and can benefit from it. But this is one of the reasons why I started investigating some 15 years ago this possibility that information is there in the world, it's available, it's a question of picking it up. And that's why I started talking about an information field, which I call the psi field first. Now I call it an Akashic field or simply the A field. I think it's there. You were connected into the A field. Although actually, we're all the time connected to the A field, but you became conscious of this connection. You were actually picking up things from this field. And then when you woke up, then some of this information that came to you informed you and suffused in your mind and became very fertile, and it changed your mind, changed your life.
What do you think the connection is with having some kind of horrible dark night of the soul? Because almost every luminary that I've talked to that's had one of these kind of epiphanies had some kind of awful dark night of the soul to happen just prior to it. What do you think the connection is?
You know, one of the principles is in any kind of creativity and any kind of building, any kind of anything that's new, is that you always have to overcome the resistance of the old. You have to forget. There was a very nice saying by a great physicist, Werner Heisenberg. He said the problem with physicists is not that they can't learn. The problem is that they can't forget. They have difficulty forgetting the old, you know. So the dark night of the soul is a way of getting us loose from the grip of habitual ways of thinking and looking at the world. It's waking up to that there is something else, you know. The force of habit is really the greatest block to creativity and to learning, because in learning one has to accept something new. And for that, sometimes you have to get a shock. And I didn't have this kind of a dark night of the soul, partly because my life has always been so unconventional that I've never been into group. I never had a kind of a routine life, not for any way that I chose it myself. It just happened like that.
Lucky you.
And I didn't even go regularly to school. I mean, I never attended to a school since I was 15, informally, you know, regularly.
Mm-hmm.
I got my degrees, but I mean, they were doing it in my own way.
Okay, let's see. I wanted to talk about that B-flat thing.
Yeah.
You have no idea how happy I was when I saw that. And I actually went on the computer and found some kind of website that I could play B-flat, and that was the sound that, of course, a different, range of notes, but it was that sound that I hear in my head. So what on the earth, how do you think that happens? I mean, also, every person that I had interviewed that had that was extremely consciously awake, if you understand what I mean by that, they all had that sound in their head.
Well, it's interesting.
How do you think?
Well, I mean, there are two things again. One is the subjective feeling of it. The other thing is to find an explanation for it, you know. The subjective feeling seems to be pretty widespread, that when you, if you're sensitive to sound, if you're not, then you can hear anything and it doesn't mean much. But if you're sensitive to sound, then the B-flat is a very comforting. It's very much like a home base, you know. It's interesting, B is in many languages coming from the Latin. It always starts with base, with a B. And it's named the B-flat. It's something which seems to be the home base for all things. Everything can be built from then. It returns to there. That's the subjective sensation. Now, the actual explanation is that there are the frequency of the pressure waves that are traveling in the cosmos that are being caused by the collapse of entire galactic cores corresponds to a basic frequency 80 octaves deeper than the audible range of B flat. But it is one of the subtonics of the B flat that we hear. So there is something in the universe which gives you this frequency, which is the most basic kind of pressure waves or wave traversing the cosmic field that we know altogether.
Uh-huh. It seems that since that's the sound, that would be the frequency upon which the original intention was placed. So if somebody hears that sound in their head and they were to meditate or place intention on that sound, it sounds like to me that it would manifest quicker.
People probably respond to that. It's more like a connecting sound. It helps us establish the contact. Let me sort of add here something which I think it's important to recognize. To me, that we are all the time connected. It's like being all the time onto the internet, you know. But then you say, how come that we don't recognize it? It's because we don't press the button which says get message, you know, when on your email system, or don't press the button which actuates an URL, so we pick up one of the websites. It's all the time is there. We are connected, but we are not aware of it. And the B-flat is a basic tone that if you become conscious of it, it helps us press the right button. You know, it helps us fine-tune our brain so that it picks up these signals. It's another analogy, you can say, is the antenna. The B-flat helps us to orient our antenna so it picks up more of this information. It picks it up in such a way that you become aware of it, you know, because it's there all the time. You're not aware of it.
That's so interesting to me. Do you think that the zero-point field, not the entire field, but the edge of it, would be the dividing line between duality, possibly? Because, you know, on that side, there's just pure potentia and black darkness, no stars or anything. And on this side, there's the stars and light and all the physical mass.
Well, first of all, I'm not sure that what is technically called the zero-point field is what actually is the most significant part, because it seems to be most electromagnetic, but it's a technicality. There is something which underlines all the manifest forms of energy and matter, you know, and mass, because as I said, matter is really forms of energy. And this underlying thing is a field, is a most basic field that there is. And that really contains everything. Out of this spring, the different particles, positive and negatively charged particles, matter and antimatter, as it's also called. And these make up the known universe and make up also our bodies. So there is no real duality, except that everything that comes forth from it always has a positive and negative charge, a yin and a yang. Mm-hmm. Always has a tension in it between two different sides, and this is what gives you the dynamism. So it's all there. It all comes from the field, because the field is energy and information together.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Do you know about magnetic monopoles?
Yeah, something like that. But,
okay.
Why does it enter?
Okay. What I wanted to know was, if you think a thought, I mean, there's got to be some way that makes things create in our life. You know, good feelings and bad feelings, the sensate things. I wondered if magnetic monopoles would be that thing that when you think a thought, it causes the energy to transmit and receive at the same time, and that would be possibly why things, what goes around, comes around. Because if you were to think a thought and it had a positive charge, then it would transmit and receive a positive charge. And maybe that would be what manifested tomorrow and the next day. If it was if somebody thought negatively all the time and it transmitted and received a negative charge, then that would be why they would constantly have, you know, negative things happening in their life. And possibly by being in the moment, not transmitting that negative charge, you know, stop doing that and get in the moment that you could possibly turn your life around. Do you think that has anything to do with magnetic monopole?
Well, it's a good analogy. It's a good way of trying to get to grips with a phenomenon that certain kinds of things attract always their own kind of things. I think there is an explanation which comes closer to what is likely to be there in reality. And that's to think in terms of holograms. Now, that seems to be also pretty far out, but
mm-hmm.
actually
no,
holograms
I believe that.
Are very, very complex patterns. And the hologram is a very curious thing, you know. It's that all the information that is contained, the hologram is contained in everyone, every little part of it. You can always regenerate the whole information from everyone, every part of it. The whole picture that's in a hologram, you can illuminate anyone, any small part of it, and that is there. So,
right.
But what's even more curious about the holograms is that when you have a whole lot of different holograms, all different kind of patterns in a complex holographic field or holographic medium, if you have one hologram, it will attach itself or start to communicate immediately with comparable holograms which have the same frequency. So the hologram chooses. It's like having like chooses like, you know, or it's like getting onto the internet and having automatically the kind of information that will pick up certain kind of homepages, certain kind of websites, and not the others. So a hologram chooses its counterparts, its communicators. So I think the same with our thoughts and with our minds, with our consciousness, also with our brain, you might say. Certain kinds of thought processes, certain kinds of thoughts and intentions will choose the corresponding kind of processes which are there in the field, which are communicated by other people. So it puts you in touch with different kinds of things. And I think that process happens, continues, although this seems to be taking it very far, but I think that continues also between lifetimes. It's probably your kind of thinking, your kind of psyche or soul, whatever you want to call it,
mm-hmm.
I call it this informational bundle that is your consciousness, continues to attract that kind of other phenomena, and so that you get reborn, you have sequential lifetimes that correspond like the idea of karma, that correspond
mm-hmm.
to the kind of thinking, the kind of intentions, the kind of mentality that you have developed in your present lifetime.
Interesting. Do you think that would have anything to do with quantum condensates?
Well, there are a lot of theories, you know, that all having their own particular origins, and it's difficult to apply them beyond a given range. But they are quantum phenomena. But the important thing is to see the context within which these phenomena take place. we are all condensates. We are all quantum condensates. We are macroscopic quantum systems ourselves, and the brain operates in that way. So certainly it would be a big mistake to think that quantum phenomena only apply to the very, very small quanta, you know, mini particles. They apply to living systems, and they apply to a brain, and our mind, our consciousness, is operating in a quantum way, in a quantum domain. It picks up information, it sends information, and it relates simultaneously to a lot of different things.
If we've got about 8 minutes left, and I want to give you the opportunity, a few minutes, to say whatever you want to say that I haven't already to ask you about that you think is important, regardless of what it is. If you had, you know, this time to say whatever you wanted to the world that would make a difference, this is your time on my show.
Okay.
If you
want to. Now?
Yeah.
Well, you're asking about a whole lot of fundamental things. I would like to be a little bit more sort of getting down to earth, so to speak, and say, why is this kind of new insight that you've been talking about, why is it so important today? And here, you know, I'll turn another page and I say, well, the crisis that we are facing is basically a crisis of, well, of understanding, a crisis of incoherence, a crisis of breakdown in communication. A crisis when persons don't understand others, don't understand nature, can't relate to the world around them. And this is resting on this mistaken belief that our consciousness is just something that's produced inside the skull, and it's super depending on the brain, and our brains are separate, and mine is over here, and yours is over there, and we can only at best communicate if we talk to each other, or if we write to each other. But the idea that we have a deeper connection is gets suppressed. It's not recognized. And this leads to a lot of loss of meaning. It leads to people believing that we are separate. Yet I'd like to quote the great psychologist William James, who said one of the last things that he wrote in his life was a reflection about what he had learned in all through his many years of investigating the psyche. And he said that finally, we are like islands in the sea. They're separate at the surface, but they're connected in the deep underneath it all. Mm-hmm. So this kind of connection to recover, or this kind of connection with each other, is fundamental to recovering meaning and to recovering the kind of understanding that we need to get along in the world with each other without out-competing each other, without killing each other, without marginalizing each other. In this interdependent and complex world, we need much more understanding. And this understanding will come much faster if we open our mind and our brain and become a receiver of all the subtle but important signals and information that we get from the world around us. Press the button which says get message, you know, and then get
right.
The message that's coming to us.
And quite frankly, it doesn't matter what people think anymore. There is no matter on the quantum level, and we are one thing, whether they like it or not.
Absolutely, yes. But so, we can jolly well kill each other in the process of not recognizing it.
That's right. That's right. We got a couple more minutes left, and I'd like for you to tell everybody where to find you, where to get your book, and about the organization that you started, the Peace Organization.
My book,
it.
I'm sure you can tell them about that. It's the most relevant book. The new edition has been published a couple of months ago. It's called Science and the Akashic Field, and an Integral Theory of Everything, which is an immodest subtitle, but it's a very real attempt to find some basic explanations for all the things that are puzzling us. And a new book is coming out now where I'm combining this kind of information, this kind of new science knowledge with the current concepts, current problems of the challenges we face in the world, about the global problems and climate change and everything else. And that's called a quantum leap in the global brain. Quantum leap in the global brain. And that will be coming, will be published in March by the same publisher, Inner Traditions.
Mm-hmm.
So these are my concern. Another book that I published was strictly on the problems that we face today called The Chaos Point, where I'm saying that we are very likely, I have only about 4 to 5 years to make some basic changes before the trends that are threatening us are going so far that for all practical purposes, we won't be able to turn them around again. And that climate is obviously one, but violence and misery and poverty and disease, etc., are all parts of that. So these are all my concerns. And the organization I found is the Club of Budapest, where we have decided to bring together spiritual people as well as scientists and writers, artists of all kinds. One of the first members has been the Dalai Lama, and then Mikhail Gorbachev, and about Václav Havel, the Czech, former Czech president, and a lot of people that that you would know, 50 of these caliber people, who are joined together with the idea that we have to bring creativity back and meaning back into our life, and you have to do it through science, but also through spirituality and through art. And we are trying to, we are publishing books, we are having meetings, and you can find that all through the website, clubofbudapest.org.
Well, thank you so much for coming on, Urban. I've looked forward to your interview for a long time. Thank you very much.
Thank you for asking all these incredibly difficult questions, but very basic and fundamental questions. And I hope that some of the answers I gave made some sense to you and to your listeners. And I'll be happy to follow up if you have further questions.
Thank you. And agape to you.
Thank you, and all the best to you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.